Hello, Tom. I mean, we're very nice to have you in Paris. And I wanted to start our discussion with a quite general question. You've been working quite extensively on the problem of free will. Could you just tell us a bit more on how you arrived to this interest for this question and what were the developments?
Well, initially, when I started in philosophy, I wasn't interested in free will at all. I was working on rational choice theory, decision theory, and game theory. I started off as an historian, then I changed to philosophy, and I went to the part of philosophy as far away from history as I could possibly find, sort of delayed adolescent revolt. And so a lot of it was sort of fairly standard contributions to how you make decision theory provide a descriptive theory of how the mind works. But it became clear to me that it was very hard to make sense of the way we think about decisions in decision theory. So we think of decisions not as a kind of passion, something that just happens to us, but something we do. But at the same time, it's a kind of motivating attitude that can occur long before the action decided upon. So we've got this inner higher order action that we go in for. And it's very hard to actually make that work in standard decision theory. You can't apply utility maximizing model to the actions of decision themselves, because their rationality is tied not to how much goodness they themselves produce, but to the justifications for their object, the action decided upon. And so decision theory tends to be forced either to treat them as Hobbes clearly regarded them, as just as a kind of passion, an antecedent of what the theory of decision theory actually applies to, or you treat them as a kind of utility maximizing action in the head, what David Gautier and various of his allies used to do. Then you get really wacko views on decision rationality. So it became clear to me that this was rather strange, especially when in the medieval tradition you have a settled tradition of understanding the primary locus of action as in the will itself and in actions of the will. The sort of theory that Thomas Hobbes was such a great opponent of in debate with Bramwell. And so I came into the problem of free will through an interest in the psychology of the will. Why freedom and action should be located in some theories but not in others, in that particular inner psychological faculty of decision making.
So thank you, because what you've just said is quite interesting and coming to my second point, which is the connection between your interest in philosophy, into philosophy of action, and your interest in history of philosophy. Yeah. So could you tell us a bit more about the way you conceive of using or going back to conceptions in classical philosophy or scholastic philosophy, and I'm thinking in particular of your interest in Suarez, and articulating this interest with what you've just said, that is, trying to figure out what could be changed into our conception of action.
If you look at a late scholastic thinker like Suarez, and I've called him late scholastic for a very good reason, he's inheriting a very lengthy tradition, which he himself recognizes as a tradition and inhabits argumentatively. You can, at one level, just take it as a tradition. And particularly in the continent, I think there's been a long tradition of history of medieval and early modern philosophy that's done just that. You relate someone like Suarez to early traditions of commentary in the Sentences, or a new tradition of commentary in Aquinas, and so forth. And you look at the tradition from the inside. And obviously, I think it's necessary to do that. And it's vastly complex and interesting to do that. But I think it's also important to look at what I call the conceptual deep structure of the sorts of theories that people are putting forward. So, for example, someone like Suarez inhabits debatable territory between, on the one hand, Thomists on the nature of action and the nature of the will, and Scotists. How far is this debate between Thomists and Scotists? Does it involve sharing, shared assumptions that someone, say, later like Hobbes will in fact effectively challenge? What is the significance of the diversity? And what, how much uniformity is in there? And to answer that sort of question, I think you then have to sit back and look what fundamentally a theory of action is supposed to do and why you get certain conceptual or theoretical decisions being made in this tradition that aren't made outside it. So I think that it's immensely interesting to look at the scholastic tradition, both as a tradition and as a locus of very general assumptions that are very particular to it, but which aren't always identified in general terms.
So what happened with Hobbes? Because Hobbes plays a very important part in your approach to those questions concerning free will. I mean, when I say what happens with Hobbes, I'm not just saying what kind of ideas, but what rupture, break in the tradition did he bring into the picture, and why did it happen at the moment when it happened?
I think in this area of the subject, when we're looking at action and the will and very general notions that are used in ethics, we might call normative notions, notions like obligation, reason and the like, what's fundamental to Hobbes is a certain view of the human-animal distinction, which is that it's not metaphysically fundamental. Some people say, and I think it's a bit quick to put it this way, but there's some truth in it. Someone like Cecil Einhorst would say this, that I think that to a very large extent, Hobbes will take a lot of the elements of the scholastic tradition on the nature of animals and just make it do general duty for humans as well. Now, why is that going on? It's going on because when it comes to human beings in the scholastic tradition, you have a very distinctive conception of the morality of the self that's bound up in the idea that we bear the image of God, which involves us being metaphysically highly distinctive amongst created corporeal beings. And this distinctiveness involves a radical difference in kind, both in the nature of our psychological capacities and the kinds of psychological states that they involve, but also in the way that we interact with the rest of nature. Because what we are, our human life involves is a receptivity to or exercise by ourselves of kinds of power that are not what I'm going to call ordinary causation. Now, ordinary causation is when I take a brick and I throw it at a window and the window breaks. That sort of thing. That's one element of material nature impacting on another element of material nature and producing an outcome through something that we are fairly comfortable with as ordinary causal force. Not everyone's comfortable with that. Obviously, famously, later on, David Hume got sceptical even about that. But beyond that, with adult human beings in the scholastic tradition, there are other kinds of capacity to produce outcomes that are not that ordinary causal force, that is not like bricks hitting windows, that involves modes of exercising power or bearers of power or ways in which power is actually exercised impacts on us that are radically distinct from those involved in ordinary causation. One kind of power is a power we exercise ourselves, which is the power of freedom, which is understood within this tradition, particularly by Suarez, very often as a kind of efficient causation. In that sense, it's like a brick hitting a window, but it's not ordinary efficient causation. It involves the cause, the bearer of the power, which is you or me, in some way controlling how the power is exercised so that the operation of the power is not dictated by its very nature, but left to its bearer. Whereas with a brick, it's just the nature of the brick's power dictates how, when it's held at the window, it's going to operate. It's going to break the window, because that's what bricks do. So you've got a very, very strange form of efficient causation, which Suarez calls contingent causation. But then, beyond that, you've got these, what I call normative powers, which are powers that are involved in something we do, but animals don't, which is exercise a capacity for reason. And they involve justifications or basis of value like truth or goodness, veritas or bonitas, operating on us through objects of thought that they attach to. So, you know, a claim looks as though it's true. It's supported by truth. It's mm-hmm. supported by the property of veritas. Another option that we might go in for looks as though it's a good idea. It's supported by goodness. Mm-hmm. It's got the property of being bonum. And these normative properties move us through the objects that they attach to, which are just objects of thought that we consider when we deliberate about what to believe or what to decide. And they move us to form the beliefs and take the decisions that are justified, that are supported by reason. And this is a power that will bypass animals completely, or pretty much completely. I mean, there's some debate about mm-hmm. that, but you know, on the whole. But it's central to how we function as bearers of reason and also how we attain happiness. Since the proper exercise of or response to these forms of normative powers will be fundamental to our well-being.
But this is precisely what Hobbes criticizes. Absolutely. When in his debate with Bramall, yes. which, by the way, you're editing for the Clarendon edition of the works of Thomas Hobbes, Hobbes clearly criticizes very precisely those ideas coming back to Suarez, but which are still there in Bishop Bramall's theology and ideas on liberty and necessity. Yeah. And so could you be a bit more specific about the way Hobbes proceeds? There is a very heavy irony also to the whole matter. So why is he proceeding like that? Why is he criticizing this normative power, which is so important to the whole setup of Suarez's thought?
Well, there are two kinds of modes of attack. One is the attack on freedom, and the other is the attack on the normative power of reason. And I think his approach is interestingly different in each case. With freedom, he is extremely aggressive. He is quite clear, quite open, that it simply doesn't exist, that it could never exist. Freedom is never a power that we ourselves could exercise to determine for ourselves what we do. The only power in nature is ordinary causation, attaching to things like bricks hitting windows or to passions in our own head to push us into action. And those bearers of power, their operation is necessitated by the nature of the power. So once I've got a strong enough desire to do something, that's just going to push me into doing it. Yeah. And Hobbes is not like a modern English language compatibilist. He doesn't say, well, that's what freedom really is, acting as you want because you want to do it. He says, no, well, that's obviously not freedom. It's not obviously self-determination. Freedom can't be a kind of power. It must be something completely different. And there is quite a complex treatment of freedom. What it comes down to fundamentally is freedom is changed from being a kind of power that's distinctive to being an absence of obstacles to power. It needn't be peculiar to human beings because rivers, for example, which are bearers of causal force, the force of their current, can be free if they're not dammed up so they can go on through to the sea. And he makes great play with this sort of thought. He's extremely aggressive about this, and I think there's more than one thing going on. One level, there is a theological program, which I think is sincere and is very, very much at the forefront of the debate with Bramall, which is Hobbes as your local Protestant hero. So anyone who thinks that there is a power of freedom must be some sort of crypto-Catholic. Since Bramall, unfortunately for Bramall, is a Laudian who clearly has a great deal of interest in Suarez, a fact that Hobbes brings acidly to attention. He says, I have not read anything in the bishop's works on predestination and grace that could not have been read in Suarez, his opuscula. This is obviously done to embarrass Bramall. it's deeply, deeply designed to make him look like an
ally
Catholic,
of
the Jesuits.
Yeah.
At the same time, there is, I think, a very, very more much more fundamental program of changing the way that law is understood. Law and obligation, if we mean by law the idea of us being subject to obligations and duties, there is an existing late scholastic theory of this that is entirely bound up with our possession of freedom as a power to determine for ourselves what we do. Because what law is directive reason as it governs and directs our power of freedom. And this function of directing freedom changes its nature. It changes its nature of being a form of advice. It would be a good idea, which you could have in relation just to beliefs that aren't within your control, to something really demanding, which you are morally responsible in a deep way for following. That's obligation. And what Hobbes is going to do is to say, well, actually, that's not a way to understand obligation at all. Obligation should just be understood as a form of directive reason backed up by commands. And it doesn't involve any anything metaphysically distinctive about you.
But he's not using the phrase directive reason.
Hobbes
is
using
not.
That.
No, you're
can
using
I come back
it.
To that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, no, no. Just
He talks about it as theorems of reason.
Yeah.
Now, what is going? So now we come back to the normative power, where the approach is much more nuanced. Interestingly, more nuanced, because what I think Hobbes is doing is he's taking all the weight away when looking at reason. Mm-hmm. From a theory of the self as very distinct, involving very distinctive human, adult human specific capacities, into something much, much more general. Is somebody either telling you to do something, or some even more fundamental way, there being some route available to you to survival, and then someone telling you to follow that. Again, that can be true for animals as well. There's a way in which the bunny rabbit can survive in relation to the fox, which is to run away or whatever. That is essentially what directive reason comes to. It's all about a stratagem to survival. But at the same time, I think Hobbes wants to hold on to the idea that you are in some way being normatively directed in some deeper way. And I think he's doing that because there's a sense in which he's got very little left of the theory of normativity unless he preserves something of that idea.
So this is an important point. What's left of this theory of normativity in Hobbes?
You can look at normativity as involving two aspects, I think. There's what I call the normativity of appraisal, which you're just rating things as better or worse. And that turns up in reason as well. You can grade people as reasonable or unreasonable. That's just grading. But we think there's another part to normativity, which is what I call the directive side of normativity, which is these standards that are normative have a capacity to move us, direct us in a way that moves us to respond to them. And so it's directive in relation to some capacity, a capacity for a reason that we possess, to respond to the direction, be moved by it.
So, for example, can we take an example? If, for example, I just ask you, why are you late? It's this question. I mean, if you answer to that question, you'll give me a justification. How come that you could understand or present this justification as a normative answer or, you know, in a normative way?
Well, I might say, oh, the reason I'm late is that there was somebody in distress on the pavement outside, and that gave me a very good justification for ringing the ambulance with my mobile, but it doesn't cost me very much except a bit of a delay, and the reasons for coming straight on were greatly outweighed by the justifications for helping someone in need. And because I'm a reasonable person, I respond to that sort of thing. So I'm treating a balance of justification as actually moving me to do what the reasonable person would do, as opposed to someone who's unreasonably selfish. Again, you know, why did you accept that proof? Well, the proof was evident. Its support for the conclusion was so compelling that I'd have had to be a nutter not to accept it. Again, my capacity for reason makes me extremely sensitive to and receptive to overwhelming theoretical justifications. So we talk about all this sort of receptivity to reason all over the place, and the theory of reason specifically is about how this receptiveness to the normative and its directive side actually works. Directions occur as justifications attaching to objects of thought that we're capable of entertaining, one could be an option by way of action, that I call the ambulance, or that I accept the proof, that I believe the proof. And these justifications then move me to believe something or to decide on it. It's not that it's that I decide to, it has nothing to do with the fact it's so justified. The justification is actually playing a role in moving me, because I'm sensible, into taking that decision, or in relation to belief, holding that belief. What Hobbes is doing is he's saying, and he says this very clearly in debate with Bramwell, that appraisal is not something that has any independent significance in normative theory. We have no idea of moral good or bad independent of or prior to the idea of obeying a law. And the idea of obeying a law is fundamentally the idea of responding to theorems of reason. What he doesn't then want to do is to say, well, actually, we have no capacity to respond to theorems of reason. What he does, I think, is he fudges.
So is it a characteristic move? Is the importance of Hobbes also related to this way of, to a certain extent, not willing to understand what is at the basis of our normative capacity to answer to reasons?
I think because he's putting so much weight on the idea of direction, as opposed to ideas of appraisal, which look as though in some ways they're less metaphysically loaded, that he's under particular pressure to fudge the extent to which he's really doing without normative power in general. This comes up in the discussion of final causation. With freedom, he's very explicit. Freedom as power does not exist. You simply are involved in a category mistake, to use a modern phrase, but that's effectively what he's saying. If you think that it is a power, it's an absence of obstacles to power, get it right. With final causation, if you look, for example, at the examination of Thomas White's De Mundo, where there is a very interesting discussion of final causation, he says, all that moves us is efficient causation. Final causation is a form of efficient causation. And this is very relevant to practical reason, because with practical reason, we have a clear case of what looks like a form of normative power that's metaphysically highly problematic. That when I take a decision to perform an action, I'm responding to a property, bonitas, which looks as though it's very much detached from the actual, because the actual could sometimes be all too bad. And it seems to attach to an object of thought that's generally just an object of thought, because generally the goals that I go for, that I decide on the basis of their goodness, precisely ones that aren't actual. Otherwise, I wouldn't be taking decisions about the matter. It would be true already. So late scholastics know all about this. They say, this is a very, very important area, metaphysically distinctive. We have this capacity to respond to non-existent objects through a very distinctive property, goodness, but in the way that involves us being subject to a form of normative power.
Interrupt you on that? Because, I mean, this is a very important point. What is the relation between this structure, which you are explaining about the normative force being, in the case of Suarez, so central, and in the case of Hobbes, transformed, with Tim Scanlon's approach to justification? What is happening in contemporary philosophy about this question of justification? What is going on? Are we returning to a certain extent to a pre-Hobbesian situation or not?
I think we're not. I think we're involved in something that's in some ways not a million miles away from Hobbes, which is an ostensible belief in reason, but which is detached from any attempt to provide a metaphysics of how reason moves us.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely because, particularly in the practical sphere, it's going to be so problematic.
Mm.
How can you have bearers of power that are non-existent? Mm. They're just mental objects moving you.
But problematic in what sense? Should we go back to some form of theological assumption just to base this metaphysics on something substantial? Or could we have this transformation of metaphysics without presupposing any kind of theological assumptions?
I don't think what's at work here is particularly theology.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, once you have a serious theory of good as a transcendental property, to use the scholastic jargon, then you will obviously be involved in a certain conception mm-hmm. of the divinity. What is fundamental here is the possibility of a form of power that's so distant from ordinary causation
mm-hmm.
that it can attach to objects that don't exist in the way that ordinary causes have mm-hmm. to exist,
yeah.
and that can operate on you through these non-existent objects, just at that level, just at the level of your entertaining objects of thought.
Mm.
That is simply not something available in contemporary philosophy of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Even a modern functionalist who wants to try and say something about what mental states are thinks that the problematic element is relating mm. mental states as bearers of ordinary causal mm. power to physical states of ordinary mm. causal power. They never think for any moment that the objects, that the intentional objects mm. of these mental states are playing an explanatory role.
Mm.
That doesn't happen in my materialist colleagues' worst nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's precisely what's going on mm. in scholastic psychological theory. It's not just that you have psychological properties that can be found in faculties detached from any bodily organs, so they're clearly not physical mm-hmm. states. Not only are they not physical states, but as playing a role in psychological explanation, they are themselves explained in terms of something that's mm-hmm. even more radically non-physical.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be, as I say, whatever an intentional object is.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these objects could never exist, as Suarez says, someone could aim at an end that mm. it's actually logically impossible for them to attain, like, mm-hmm. you know, proving an impossible yeah. proof in maths.
Mm-hmm.
There's an object there, a goal, that mm-hmm. it would be impossible for anyone ever to attain, yeah. but it could still move them.
Yeah.
So this is how problematic it is.
Mm. And could you relate this discussion on this nature of bonum in psychological theory with the question of the common good in politics? Is there a relationship between the two? Are there problems associated with the way we tend to think about the common good in contemporary political theory? Or what could you say about that?
Well, here's
about political yeah. normativity.
Yeah.
I mean, is
here's,
this the
here's something about the state, which is a very distinctive way of thinking about the state that's common to the scholastic tradition, but which you won't find in modern political philosophy as a whole, but which it's very natural to use. It's the idea of the state's authority. Within the scholastic tradition, as arguably, I think, in the Roman law tradition mm-hmm. as well, states have forms of right mm-hmm. or authority that no individual could ever possess. Very central one, the right to punish.
Mm-hmm.
A state has a right to punish you, but no individual human being could ever have a right to punish another mm-hmm. human being. They lack the authority. This is not like Locke's State mm-hmm. of Nature, in which mm-hmm. before the coming of the state, people go around as private individuals in Locke's State of Nature, having a right to punish each other for mm-hmm. violating the law of nature. That simply couldn't happen. Why should there be this distinction between these two political right. traditions? And it's actually, I don't think a scholastic theory is nuts at all. I mean, a lot of people would say, of course I don't have a right to punish you. Of course I don't have the authority.
Mm-hmm.
There's something very odd about Locke's conception of individual human beings, just as other individual human beings, having a right to go around, stand and judge a jury on mm-hmm. each other. How do you do that? But why should then this authority be peculiar to the state? That's the question. And it's not just an ungrounded feature of the scholastic tradition. They have a story about why this is so, which connects to this whole problem about practical reason and normative power. And the story is this. Human beings have a natural capacity to respond to reason. This involves a capacity to respond to normative power. Power of truth at the level of theory, the power of goodness at the level of practice, at the point of the intellect and the will. But not all forms of normative power are ones that individuals are naturally receptive to, because there is a distinctive good associated with a community. The thought is this, that we can only flourish as members of a flourishing community, but what it is for a community to flourish cannot be understood just in terms of what it is for an individual to flourish. Even if the same goods turn up, like property...
So what's the difference?
Well, what is going to be of very great importance, I think, is going to be the implications for other human beings who are not personally connected to us, but with whom we live in a community, just as fellow members of community at a very general level. Mm. What is going to be of very importance is going to be the significance for them of the way we ourselves live. Mm-hmm. And I think one very, very natural way of understanding this is this thought, that even as someone unconnected to me personally, my happiness is very, very much bound up mm-hmm. with your attitudes to me just as another human mm-hmm. being. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not something that greatly disturbs my private life, where I'm relating to you as a friend, mm-hmm. or possibly as an enemy, mm-hmm. or someone with whom I'm just personally connected in some sort of complicated way. But it's very much bound up with the way I relate to you just as another human being. Mm-hmm. And to think about that, the scholastics think, we actually need to go beyond our own individual life, because we're not capable, naturally, of thinking about that sort of thing, just as individuals. What we have to do, and then this affects the practical sphere, how will I react to you just as another individual human being, not as a neighbour? How much or how little will your interests count? Well, just as a private individual, I'm not very good at thinking about that. Mm-hmm. Because actually, those are not terms in which, just as a private individual, I relate to you. Mm-hmm. What we need, and what we've been designed to produce, are special institutions that enable what we now call public reason mm-hmm. to take place at all.
Yeah.
And those are the institutions of the state. So the reason why the state has certain forms of authority that individuals never possess is that the state is at the institutional level at which we first become capable of public reason, the kind of reason that is involved in decisions to punish people, and arguments for why those decisions are reasonable. So fundamental to this story is a story about the metaphysics of normative power and how we are receptive to normative power. And it's that story that then includes the state as a distinctive player and radically changes the nature of public reason from what it is in modern liberal political theory. In modern liberal political theory, public reason is a level at which beliefs become common property between people whom we regard or appraise as reasonable. And it provides a boundary framework within which, on certain versions of the theory, you're allowed to appeal in public discussion. So it will exclude religion and it will exclude certain sort of refined forms of metaphysics about the good, because those aren't common property. Reasonable people could disagree about them. But we're talking about the availability of reason to individuals. Yeah. And we're not talking about it as involving any responsiveness to directive power at all. It's just there in a way that's not really metaphysically unpacked. It's really a story of talking about the politically acceptable, the level of public discourse. Yeah. Public reason for Suarez is something that we're not actually receptive to just as individuals. It requires and presupposes public institutions rather than a vocabulary in which you could introduce people to them. And it's actually a form of reason that moves us, which is why the Suarezian state is, as I sometimes describe, a coercive teacher. The distinctive institutions of the state that are involved in legal direction and legal punishment are all about ensuring that we are properly receptive to something of which we would not have much of an understanding without the state, which is public reason, yeah, as it involves the good of the community.
Thank you. Thank you very much. A last question. How are you going to develop those ideas? Have you got specific projects concerning those? This representation of the state as being a teacher or being something which sounds to a certain extent very illiberal, very contrary to some varieties of liberalism, just as, let's say, a million form of liberalism?
Well, I think that the very, very interesting figure in all this is somebody whose significance I think people like my colleagues, Tim Scanlon, and his friends in Harvard rationalism, as I call it, are rather in denial about, is David Hume. Because David Hume is somebody who says what I think Hobbes is already effectively believing, but not so openly saying, that there is no such thing as being moved by reason. Reason never moves us. Only psychological states that are bearers of ordinary causal power ever move us.
Passions.
But, I mean, the non-cognitive nature of these states I don't think is as important. Someone like Tim Scanlon will say, well, what Hume's about is saying that beliefs don't move us. I don't think actually Hume really rules out beliefs moving us. I mean, expectations of pain or pleasure move us in the treatise and their beliefs. What he's ruling out is normative power moving us. And if you want to say normative power doesn't move us, then you are in the land of Hume. And you are going to have to provide a theory of normativity that's fundamentally what Hume was trying to provide, which is a theory of appraisal that doesn't involve a serious theory of direction. That's the Humean project, and of course it involves a project in political theory, because Hume is a very, very interesting but much neglected political theorist who is doing political theory without a theory of normativity as reason, but providing a very interesting political theory all the same. So what a lot of my work is going to be involved in is looking, on the one hand, at the project of doing rationalism without metaphysical tears, or metaphysically quietist forms of rationalism, which I don't think is very respectable. On the other hand, there's Hume's complete reason skepticism. And then, somewhat in the middle, there are forms of late scholastic political theory and also ethical theory, which do take the metaphysics of direction very seriously, but they go further. In some ways, they're quite like Hume. They don't think you can understand rational direction just in terms of a bare structure of reason. They think that you also have to inform the theory of rational direction with a theory of appraisal. Modern virtue theory often thinks that directive reason and obligation is one thing, virtue is another thing. This tradition is saying, no, the way we understand normativity of directing us is precisely through standards of moral good and bad. As my parents used to say to me when they introduced me to the nature of moral obligation, they said, it would be very bad of you to hit your little sister. So they were introducing a form of appraisal.
Which is very true.
Which was actually used to communicate an idea of rational direction. So we've got Hume on one side, the rationalist on the other. And I think the scholastic tradition is very interestingly in the middle, but perhaps not so much its metaphysics, where of course it is very distant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.